A salary is the drug they give you when they want you to forget about your dreams.
Welcome to the Corporate Dropout Podcast. I'm your host, Alessia Citro. After a successful career in tech, suffering from burnout, stress, and anxiety, I walked away from a multiple six-figure career to chase my passions and purpose as a coach and entrepreneur. This show is going to inspire, equip, and empower you to do the same. Let's get it. Hello, friends. Today's interview is with Jacqueline Samira, one of my very best friends for the last 16 years and an incredible entrepreneur. She's also the first person I call when I have a business idea I need to kick around. Jacqueline is the founder and CEO of Austin Software. Let me ask you, listeners, what do Airbnb, Instacart, Stripe, and Dropbox have in common with Jacqueline? They are all Y Combinator graduates. Austin Software is essentially making top-tier software engineers accessible to companies who aren't big enough to compete with the likes of Google. Jacqueline, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I always get so embarrassed with those intros, but that was very nice. Thank you.
Well, you know, it is always hard for us to brag on ourselves, but it's not bragging if it's based in facts, and you're impressive. So
that's it. True. That is true. It's always a nice reminder.
So, okay, to kick things off, let's tell our listeners about you and your professional background. I want to touch on this in more depth than I usually do because you have a very interesting resume and you got a very different start than most tech CEOs. So you've been an entrepreneur since we graduated from college and your very first venture was in the beauty industry. I remember because I was a customer there. Can you tell us a little bit about that first venture and what you learned from it?
Yeah. So when I was in college, I was interning at a magazine and I did this event for something. I don't even remember, but I got connected to this guy and he's like, look, I've got this friend. She's got a lot of money. She wants to start a business, but she has like no business savvy or acumen whatsoever. Can you help her? Can I hire you to help her? And so essentially, when I was 20, I was hired on as a co-founder of this company where she wanted to essentially help women who are losing their hair have non-surgical hair restoration. And it was great. It was fun. It was one of those like feel-good missions. And I did a lot of research and we emulated at the time a company called Hair Club. They were synonymous with getting bald men their hair back. And so we wanted to do something very similar for females. And it was based in Southern California.
I have to say too, when I was a customer there, that was some of the best Brazilian blowouts I ever got.
So, yeah, we didn't do just, it wasn't just hair restoration. It was also just making your hair even prettier. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And you had the cutest place too. Like I still, when I drive down PCH and see it, it's like, I get all the nostalgia. So after that venture, you actually went back into the corporate world and started working for Hair Club for Men and Women. And you were there for 6 years. How did that role set you up for the next step and what you're doing now?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So we built this little business. We started to get a lot of traction. And it turns out that my co-founder didn't want to work that much. She's used to being wealthy and she used to like be traveling around the world. And so we ended up closing up shop. And at the time I had all this knowledge and all this insight. And so I said to myself, well, since I know so much about this, I might as well take this and leverage it into a career with Hair Club. Reached out to one of the directors at the time and said, hey, you know, interview me for a sales role. I know I could kick butt here. And I wanted to be at their biggest office because I knew if I got into corporate America, I needed to make a name for myself in a place that, you know, was important to their bottom line, which ended up being in New York City. Ended up getting hired. This was in 2009. And gosh, I took everything I could, moved across the country and just started doing sales for Hair Club for Men. And very quickly, I got promoted to be their national sales trainer. One of the best things, and I tell this advice to just young people, as many young people as I can, was the best thing I did for my professional career was work in corporate America because they had so many systems and so many processes and just so many resources to help somebody that is young and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and just excited to take on the world. I got the best training from them. It was like paid graduate school, so to speak. And so I just thought it was a phenomenal experience. I learned a ton and I took advantage of all the resources that they had available because, you know, when you're young and you're not well connected, I didn't come from a family of people that were in business. My mom's an immigrant. My dad's a professor. You know, we didn't know people. I didn't have that kind of network. And so I just took what I could. And especially for someone like me, going into a corporate type job was the best education I could have given myself.
I could not agree more with that, with all of it, like such similar backgrounds, you and I, like my dad being an immigrant too. And like, yeah, I mean, if you don't have those contacts or professional mentorship growing up, like there is no better training ground than corporate America. Like I know the show is called Corporate Dropout, but it's like, don't get it twisted. Like I would not be anywhere had I not worked for, you know, wonderful companies and gotten all that training.
You couldn't be a corporate dropout if you didn't know what you know now.
Oh, total, like not a chance. Also, I have to tell everyone, if you hear a kid screaming in the background, it's because my kid is homesick from school. So I think you might've heard her yell when Jacqueline was talking back there, but you know, mom life, we're going to keep it real.
Totally. And mine's going to wake up any moment now. So.
Oh man. Yep. But hey, we manage anyway, right? Totally. Okay. So after Hair Club, you then jumped into a VP of sales role in the tech space. There are so many people that I talk to that feel very pigeonholed in whatever industry they're currently working in. How did you make the transition from hair to digital media? And what advice would you give to someone who's looking to break into a different industry?
I love this question. So at the time, I became promoted to national sales trainer. And then in my second or third year there, I got promoted to regional sales manager, which like equivalent in corporate America, I had 20 centers or 20 locations all across the Southeast. I had, you know, 40 salespeople underneath me. I was managing a budget of $28 million. So it's not like a typical sales manager role. It was a pretty legit sales manager role. And one of the things that I was doing at the time was I did feel pigeonholed. I felt like this is where I had to stay or I had to be in comparable industries because my resume wouldn't necessarily match the opportunities that I wanted. So I started studying to go back and get my MBA because one of the things they tell you when you go to get your MBA is this is really good if you want to advance your career where you're at right now or if you want to move lateral to a different type of career. And so that's what I thought. I thought that was my only path forward was to go and get me my MBA. And as I was doing it, I don't remember where I got this advice, but I had heard somewhere where women apply for the job that they're qualified for and men apply for the job that they want. And that really resonated with me because here I am being like, well, I'm only qualified for these things. And so I must go back and get my MBA in order to be qualified. I mean, it was just like such a stupid way of thinking about it. And I had known a couple people just through my own personal network that was in tech. And I just said, screw it. I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to apply everything that I've done in the industry that I've been at. Like I've done some impressive things and I think I can make it translate to what they're working on in the tech world or what they're working on in the startup world. All I needed was just access. I just needed someone to give me a chance to interview with them. And so I just said, screw it. I'm not going to pay to go get my education. I'm going to go and get that job that I want. And I applied to a bunch and got lucky and got one.
I love that. Well, and I think too, like people who do want to go back and get their MBA, if that is actually something that they need to advance, like use your corporate company to pay for it because many of them will, or at least subsidize part of it too.
Yeah, totally. And like, there's nothing wrong with going back and getting your MBA. I think it's a great option and a great opportunity. I just thought that that was my only option. And when I heard that quote or whatever it was, I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to go for it. And if I get an opportunity doing the thing I want to do and I can make that big leap, like great. And if I can't, I always have the MBA as my fallback.
Totally. Well, so a couple of things on this. I actually wanted to go back and get my MBA when I was working at Salesforce. And my manager at the time was like, why? You don't need that. You're not going to get an ROI on that. He's like, look at what you're doing day to day.
Right.
You're having like 10 conversations a day with business owners. Like you're getting your Salesforce MBA. That's what we would call it internally. And it's so true. Like I think a lot of times it can be overkill. There's one other thing I wanted to touch on too before we move on. And it was what you said about women preparing for the job or applying for the job that they are qualified for. when I was at Google, I became a facilitator for I Am Remarkable. It started out as a Google initiative, but now like it's, you know, all over the globe. Anyone can become a facilitator and lead these workshops. One of the things they taught us is that Hewlett-Packard did a study internally to figure out why women weren't applying for management positions. And what they found is that women apply for a job when they meet 100% of the requirements. Do you have a guess on how many, like what percentage of the requirements men apply at?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. 50%, maybe less.
60. Yep. So ladies, if you're listening to this, you are probably overqualified.
I mean, I'm going to fast forward in my career just a little bit, just to kind of add an antidote to that. When I was reviewing resumes for account executives in tech companies, I mean, all the female resumes were just phenomenal, like matched everything we were looking for. And I would be getting the most insane resumes coming from the male counterparts. I'm like, you were a server at a restaurant, like, which is awesome. Like, good on them for, you know, throwing their hat in the ring. No, but it really, really, really validated that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Women don't think enough of themselves. Like, we got to get the swagger that the men have, ladies. So yeah. Let's all work on that.
Totally.
All right. So let's talk about your next role. So after this VP of sales role, you then became head of sales for a connected freight platform that had financial backing from Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and Reid Hoffman. Tell us about that experience. Is that what you feel propelled you into the tech startup space?
Well, so I became VP of sales for this company called, where I was VP of sales was this company called Own Local. And essentially what they did is they took traditional media and they converted it into online marketing campaigns. I felt like that was really what pulled me into the tech world. They were a Y Combinator company. They were like OG Y Combinator. I think they were winter 2010. I had a lot of connections through them. Through that I was able to meet some other like really cool Y Combinator founders. The first year I was there, we went from $4 million in revenue to $12 million in revenue. So I ended up getting a little bit of momentum and got to create a network within Austin from that. When I started with Shipwell, we had no customers, no revenue, nothing. It was just basically an MVP of a product, minimal viable product, but it wasn't even that. Like, it didn't even work. I remember like my first day on the job, I was able to get a new customer and we didn't even know how to create a login because like that's how like not working or functional it was.
Oh my God.
But yeah, so I would say that the opportunity before that was what really gave me my leg in. And this was the first experience I had where we took something from nothing to something. And that was a really remarkable opportunity.
Do you think that that is what really gave you the confidence to be able to go out and build your own thing from scratch?
100%. I knew you've known me for a long time. I've always had this entrepreneurial spirit. I've always wanted to do something on my own, but I never had the faith in myself to do it. Even though I've had a very successful career and I've shown and proven time and time again that I can gain traction, I can, you know, add to growth and aid in growth, I had never taken something from nothing to something. And so being able to do that with an industry I had absolutely no experience and no familiarity with, that really did tell me like, you know what the hell are you doing? You're making so many people rich. Like, what? Stop working for others. You've got this, you can do this. And so, yeah, that is 100% like what I needed to go out and do something on my own.
That's another thing I noticed too with women is like, we tend to like feel as though we're not going to be capable of doing a certain thing. But then once we do it, it's like, well, now I can go conquer the world. And so it's like, you have to get the reps in, you have to get the experience and then just use that as like the stepping stone to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. But so many people are held back by fear that they won't even try.
Yes. I actually just did a talk for my internal company just now, and it was called How to Start a Company for the Risk-Adverse Entrepreneur.
Oh, wow. That needs to be like a TED talk. I feel like there are a lot of people who need to hear that. Okay. So I wasn't planning on asking you this, but like, let's go there. Like what would you say are like two or three things that someone who is incredibly risk averse should do to get over that and go for it?
So for me, my biggest hurdle was knowing that I can do it. And then the second biggest hurdle was money. if you're risk adverse, you want to make sure that you can pay your bills every single month and you aren't going to go and live in a poorhouse or you're not going to ruin your credit. Because again, if you're risk adverse, you probably care about your credit. My husband, who's also an entrepreneur, does not care about any of that stuff. He would totally be fine destroying his credit if it meant giving himself an opportunity. I'm not like that. And so one of the other things that was really important to me was that I had enough in a savings account that would sustain me for 6 months to a year, given that the business wasn't getting any kind of traction. So I would say, one, having to have the faith, but two, definitely some sort of nest egg so that you're not afraid of not making money. Because when you lead decisions based on fear, you're going to make bad decisions.
It's so true. I feel like setting up that like safety net, so to speak, is huge before you do it. I mean, that was the only way that I was able to be like, okay, I'm walking away from this incredibly high paying job and these insane benefits. Like, I built up the net so that I could do that. I think otherwise you start doing things out of desperation, people can smell it and you're just kind of, you're doomed.
Well, you have this like grand aspiration of what you want your business to be, but then someone offers you money, but it like bastardizes your vision, but you need the money. So you're like, okay, I'm going to do it. And then now all of a sudden you're like some weird consultant doing some weird thing that you never even wanted to do to begin with.
100%. Yeah. You're going to be able to stay true to your vision if, oh, I'm glad that we can hear you in the background. It's not just me and Mila. Yeah. You're not going to be able to stay true to your vision if you have to like sell out, so to speak. So I think that's great advice. So before we move on to founding Austin Software, any other like really key takeaways from the experience at Shipwell? I feel like that is totally what set you up to just go like kick ass and take names.
Well, you asked it. So I'm going to share. So actually what gave me the courage to do it, because I am, and probably so many people listening right now, when you work for a company, especially from the beginning, you have a sense of loyalty and you have a sense of dedication to them, especially if you also help them build it to be where it is, that the idea of walking away is something that a lot of people can't do. It's something I couldn't do. And actually the courage that allowed me to walk away was I had been working with them for 14 months. The first 3 months that I was there, I didn't take a paycheck. I said, bring me on, like, just start me at the salary. And then if we raise money or if we do this, then back pay me or like pay me back what you owe me, but I'm okay. Like, so that was my first risk. Like, don't pay me. Just like, give me this opportunity to start this company with you. And 3 months in, we raised the $2 million from Jeff Bezos and all these like amazing famous people. And we got traction. 9 months later, we raised a $10 million Series A, and I didn't take one vacation, one break. I didn't do anything. And so after we raised the money, I went on a week trip vacation to Alaska, and I come back and I had set up all of our internal communications so that it would go into our CRM, so that anybody that was talking, any of my salespeople that were talking to people, I could go in and help them with communications or see. But it also connected to the email accounts of our CEO. And fun fact, our CEO, while I was on vacation, had offered a guy my job and offered him, I'm not kidding you, $500,000 a year.
I don't think you ever told me this story before.
It like, I'm like still getting so hot and angry from it.
But anger can fuel you though. So like, I'm here for that.
So here I am having killed myself. Like, mind you, this guy had this company for a year, didn't do jack shit with it. Couldn't get any traction. And 3 months, we now have $2 million to work with. 9 months later, we have $10 million to work with. And he's sitting there writing this guy like, hey, you know, basically it was just this like old school logistics guy that's been in the logistics business and has all these like logistics network. I mean, it's like one of those, like, imagine like big fat lazy man that sits in an ivory tower that just takes credit for everybody else's work. Uh-huh. Like, this is who I picture. This is the guy that they were giving my job to. And they had the audacity to ask me to step down and report to him.
Oh, nope.
So I gave him.
I heard this story before.
Oh, yeah. It was, I can say it freely because I never signed exit paperwork.
let that be a lesson to all of you founders if you screw someone over. Oh my God. Well, that must've felt kind of good though, to walk out and like drop the mic that like, no, I'm out of here. See you later.
Yeah, no, I said, I was like, no. I was like, there is no way in hell I'm going to continue to kill myself so other people can take my glory and my credit.
100%. And get paid way more than you, too.
Way more. 5 times as much.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, that would make my stomach turn. So then remind me, what happened then between Shipwell and when you go to found Austin Software? Because like we were just talking about, like, you know, you build up a safety net, you kind of like build up your plan, but like this obviously was a bit unexpected. So like, tell us about that gap period.
So what ended up happening was I've just been a saver in general. So I did have a little bit of a nest egg. And they had owed me money from, you remember I told you I didn't take any salary. And then like they had owed me some money. And so they paid me that. And that gave me enough. And I told myself, I'm like, you know what? I've never not worked from the time I was in college to the time I'm 32, 12 straight years of just working. Even when I would go between company and company, I would never even take time off in between. I like never gave myself time. And so I said to myself, this was August when I quit, August of 2018. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take the rest of the year off. Come January 2019, I'm going to start to just like focus and see what I want to do. And that lasted about a month before I got really bored. And what ended up happening is I got connected to this company that needed help with their sales team and needed help with their growth. So I took on a consulting project, mostly just out of boredom. But I will say, like, the idea of Austin Software had started because of Shipwell as well. Just to give some background knowledge, you know, we didn't have any money. We were building it up with smoke and mirrors, trying to sell like this future idea of what it would be once we were able to raise money. We raised money and it was still really hard to hire really good engineering talent because they were all taken by like these amazing companies. And, you know, if you wanted a staff level engineer or a senior architect to help you design this product, I mean, you had to pay through the nose for that role. And so we ended up working with a company called Endella, which I love the mission of the company. Essentially what they do is they help African developers in Nigeria, by giving them opportunities for American tech companies, and tech companies benefit from it because it's, you know, $4,000 to $6,000 a month. So they're saving a lot of money, but then they get to work with great talent overseas. So we worked with them, but the time zone was really, really rough. And what we realized was they tended to be a little bit more junior than what we were looking for. So I was like, you know, that mission is very close, but it's not right. And the thing I kept thinking about in my head over and over was that talent is everywhere. There are smart people all around the world, but the opportunities are just hyper-focused in a certain, you know, small areas of America, the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Southern California, Austin, Texas, New York City. These are where all of the funding, all of the VC, all the capital is going. And people historically, at least pre-COVID, only wanted to hire people within their cities that would come into the office, people that they could see their faces. And so at that time, being, you know, on the hiring committee, trying to hire great engineering talent, it was so difficult to do. And so that just started like kind of like percolating in the back of my head. And I started to work as a consultant for this company called ChatFuel, which is also another Y Combinator company. They're based in San Francisco. So I was flying out to San Francisco every week. It was really fun, like took my mind off things. They had a really great product. It was super easy to sell. They're all engineers, you know, when you're engineers, a lot of times you don't know the value of what you have. I mean, you do, but you also like, how do you position it? How do you talk to people about it? How do you get people to give you, you know, way more money than you're already asking them for? And so that was a really, really fun experience. But the thing that was the most amazing thing about that experience is their entire development team was located in Moscow. And it was like, for the first time in several years, I was part of a product company where they were actually delivering new features. And I mean, it's going to sound insane. They were delivering new features every sprint, like they're supposed to. But, you know, having been a part of like a train wreck of a company that couldn't get anything out the door, it just felt like felt like Christmas every Friday when they were showing us what was new and cool and exciting about what it is that they had worked on all week. And what I realized was it was so easy to hire phenomenal talent in Moscow because the engineers there wanted to be a part of this really cool, exciting American tech company. And so ChatFuel, while based in San Francisco, was like the most exciting company in Moscow for people to be a part of. And so they were able to grow their development team, right? They were able to grow their development team. They had like a team of 30 in their office in downtown Moscow. And I mean, the vibe, the culture, everything was just phenomenal. And so at that time, I was like, you know what? This is it. Like, this is what we have to do. But the problem with Moscow, again, is the time difference. And I was like, I literally pulled out a globe and I'm looking up and down like the Western Hemisphere. And I'm just like, where are all the good engineers? and I knew at the time that there was this like emerging market happening in Latin America. And that is how the idea started to evolve for Awesome Software.
Wow. So how did you end up settling on a location in Latin America? I feel like I've worked with companies actually that have had, you know, development teams in Argentina, you know, in different countries, but like, how did you kind of hone in on the spot to go?
So this was, I had had a couple of recommendations from people who had worked with some companies in Colombia, some companies in Argentina, some people in Uruguay, some people in Chile, like all over. So what I did is I just went down there and I said to myself, like, I'm going to meet these people. I'm going to go to these different offices and I'm going to see culturally who is most similar to American developers, because I knew there was going to be a big hurdle. Again, this is pre-COVID. So go back to 2018, 2019, where like you went to office every single day and the idea of working from home was non-existent. So I knew I had to overcome the hurdle of if this is going to be a remote team, can they be like as culturally similar to America as possible? And what country has that so that we can start there? And it turns out Montevideo, it was like, I mean, you go down there, you feel like you're just like in like the South American OC. Like,
really?
Yeah, it is like, it is so chill. They've got like, it's like a surfer vibe, but they're all soccer players. So like no one really surfs. But I mean, it's just culturally, it was so similar. It was so similar. And a fun fact, 80% of the population speaks English because all of their public schools are English immersion since kindergarten.
Oh, wow.
So you go ahead.
For those of you who don't remember the South American capital song from Spanish class, she's talking about Uruguay, right? that's where Montevideo, that's literally the only reason I know because of that capital song. That's I'm sing it for you, but.
That's true. It's a very small country. It's like there's 2 million people in the whole country. It's very small.
Wow.
But it's very, very tech forward. It's a phenomenal like little country with a huge middle class, very highly educated. Majority of the citizens have their master's degrees. Everything's funded. Everything's paid for. So I thought to myself, like, okay, if we're going to start a small team, the idea, again, for Awesome Software was, can we find great talent, great engineers in Latin America and help connect them with US tech companies? And so I started there. And that's how I did. I just culturally, not to say that these other countries weren't great and these other cities weren't great. They are. They're all phenomenal. But it was easier to connect at the very beginning with somebody that is, you know, very, very similar.
Oh, totally. Well, and you know, just how good the English must be too, if they've been in immersion since kindergarten. And what time zone is Montevideo in? It's got to be a US time zone, right?
Yeah. It's so half the year, because they don't participate in daylight savings, half the year, they are essentially 1 hour less than New York time zone. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty.
That's great.
It's great. And the country tends to start their day a little bit later and end their day a little bit later. So they work US time zones. It's pretty much the same.
Oh, that's perfect. So what were some of the biggest challenges in founding Austin Software? And what do you think, kind of piggybacking on that too, what do you think aspiring entrepreneurs need to be aware of if they do found a company? Like, what are some of the pitfalls?
Oh my gosh.
You could probably talk about this just for an hour on its own, right?
Totally. So I had assumptions about what I thought would work. You always have assumptions, right? Because you have your own personal experiences, but you don't understand other people's experiences. And so I wouldn't say that this is a pitfall that I fell into, but it's a pitfall I see a lot of founders fall into, is that they just don't ask enough questions of their early customers or their early prospects to truly understand what they want. Because you have this idea, but you can't force it down anybody's throat. You have to make your idea match their needs. You have to make your solution match their problems. And so I think in the early days, what I did that I'm really happy I did was I just did a lot of research and asked a lot of questions. Hey, talk to me about your hiring needs. Hey, what are your problems? Well, what are your concerns with working with someone remote? And what are your issues? And why haven't you done this before? And what have you done before? And, you know, just really trying to find a like thorough understanding, because if you're going to go and invest all your money and time and resources into starting something, you want to make sure that people want the thing that you're actually doing. And and also in the beginning, you kind of have to give it away for free because they're your guinea pig. And if they're your, and you got to tell them too, like, hey, like you were my first customer. It's okay to be the first customer. Sometimes people like love being someone's first customer because they know they get like all the special treatment. They get special deals. They get all these special things. And so I had a really cool first partner that was struggling hiring. And I said that, I was like, you know, you're my guinea pig. Like you are my first customer. Talk to me. They had their own assumptions about what they wanted. I had my own assumptions, but I really worked with them in what they were looking for. And so I said, look, just be patient with me while I get this off the ground. I'm going to help you source this talent and we're going to go from there. So some of the pitfalls I did fall into though was hiring in a foreign country is difficult. And part of the reason it's difficult is because one, I thought I could hire them as international contractors, which like technically you can, but in Uruguay, they have great national benefits. So they have great healthcare. They have great pension. They have great like benefits, like everything. And if you don't work with a local company, if you work with a foreign company, you don't get access to any of the national benefits.
Oh, so, that would be a big stopping point.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, screw it. Let's just start a company in Uruguay then. So I started a company. I set up a company in Uruguay. It costs a whole bunch of money. You know, they do a lot of things like very old school. You have to be in person and sign with a blue ink pen. You can't do anything digital. If you want to open up a bank account, you have to meet and have like an in-person meeting with the head of the bank. And, you know, like all of these, like what I would imagine looked like starting a business in like the 1970s. It was kind of fun. It was interesting. So I offered a bunch of people jobs. I got a bunch of great access to talent, but because I didn't have a Uruguayan entity, I couldn't hire these people because no one wanted to work internationally because they would lose out on those benefits. And so I was like, okay, screw it. Like, let's just go down there. Well, went down there, set it all up, and I did the conversion. I did all the math. I was like, all right, this is how much it's going to cost to employ them. I told the partner, my first customer, I'm like, this is how much it's going to cost to employ them. Well, it turns out there were like three things I didn't know and people were trying to explain it to me, but like, how do I say this in the most interesting way? When you get paid time off in Uruguay, you understand paid time off to say like, if Alicia gets $100 a day for her job, when you take the time off, you still get $100 a day, right? Well, paid time off in Uruguay is not $100 a day. It's $200 a day.
Oh my gosh. So everyone uses all their PTO.
Not only do they use all their PTO, because what they said was, this is after they were charging me all this extra money I wasn't planning for. What they said, they're like, well, that's vacation pay. And I'm like, what do you mean vacation pay? And they're like, well, you can't use your salary for vacation. That's what you get vacation for.
Yes. What?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. There's a concept.
There's a concept. I was like, oh my gosh. Okay, cool. So this thing, so it gets worse. So I didn't budget that in, because when they told me, oh, you know, Uruguayans get 20 days off in PTO, I'm thinking, okay, I've got 20 days that I have to pay for these guys. I'm not thinking I have 40 days that I have to pay for them, you know?
Right. Right.
That was interesting. And that was definitely costly. And
did
then
you have to go back to your first customer then and say like, hey, actually, I need to charge you more because this is what it really is. Like, that must have been a fun conversation to have.
Yeah, that was a fun conversation because they were like, well, that's not what we agreed to. So I paid it.
Oh my God. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, but on that note, let's talk about other financial sacrifice too. Oh, yep. There's Mila. you actually went without pay for quite a while to get Austin Software going. So like, yeah. what was that like? So like, I feel like you're definitely doing the right thing so much, like eating the cost of this that you didn't know about, going without pay on top of it. Like, what was that like? That must have been kind of a little scary, right?
Totally. I mean, so the first customer, you know, we weren't charging any profit. It was just a pass-through cost. And then I was actually losing money because, like I said, it was the PTO. There was a couple other things like that occurred as well. So I did have that. I did have a little bit of a savings. So I was living off of my savings. I told myself that I would pay myself once I had a month's worth of salaries for my developers in the company bank account. And the reason being is because like my business model I set up was risky intentionally to get more people. And the risk of it was I didn't have any long-term contracts. I just said, you know, pay me week to week, fire them whenever you want. My idea was like, if they're a good engineer, you're not going to want to fire them. So in the event that this person got fired, I didn't want to personally fire them. I wanted to be able to place them on a new team. And so I needed to have a little bit of float to do that. And so as we grew the company and as we had more and more engineers on board, that was more and more money I had to save. And so it was like, I kept trying to constantly chase this goal. So the second customer, the third customer, of course, we put in a little bit more margin, a little bit more margin, a little bit more margin. It eventually worked out to be, it took 20 months for me to give myself a first paycheck.
Oh my gosh. How exciting was that first paycheck? Like, did you do a cartwheel or...
You know,
a bottle of champagne or
you would think that I would do any of those things, but I was my first paycheck was also the month I gave birth to my baby. And
that in itself is amazing that you did this while pregnant.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, but your first paycheck was the month that you gave birth to your child.
And I went through all my money. I went through 100% of my savings and I had cashed in actually one of my retirement accounts, fun fact. And I basically was like living till the very, very end. And then I had a baby, which is very expensive. Another fun fact, my baby shower got canceled because of COVID. And right. It was just, there was like all this confusion. And so like, there were so many things that I was expecting to get from friends and family, which I know that sounds horrible, but you know, there's like,
no, it doesn't though. I mean, that makes up a big chunk of the stuff that you need because babies are really expensive. They need so much stuff nowadays.
They need so much stuff. And I was so grateful because I had so many, I mean, of course, like you obviously gave an amazing baby shower gift. And by the way, your the bunny is Ace's lovey. So like, I think of you all the time. But so then there was all this confusion. Do we wait for the, are we going to do the baby shower later and then give the gifts? So it was just like all this. And I wouldn't care. I wouldn't have cared, but I literally had like, no joke, $400 in my bank account. And I still had a mortgage I had to pay. I still had bills I had to pay. I still had all of these things that I was like, fuck, like, and this baby is due any moment. So my first paycheck was $2,000. And I was like not doing champagne shots or popping champagne or doing backflips. I was like crying because I was just relieved that I wasn't like going to go into bankruptcy.
Yeah. Well, and I think it just shows like how much you were willing to bet on yourself that you continued to go and like cash out a retirement account because you knew this was going to happen. It was just when, not if. I feel like most people at that point would have been like, all right, guys, like I'm hanging it up. That's it. So kudos to you that you kept going. I bet you're pretty glad now, right?
You know, oh my God, I'm so glad now. And also too, in those moments, like, you know how you say like the universe sends you signs and they send you messages and they send you all those things. There was like a lot of messaging I was getting at the time that was saying, you know, a lot of people quit right before things are about to take off. And so I just kept like, the company was growing, the vibe was good, customers were happy. And I just knew, I knew we were on the brink, but like, it just hadn't happened yet. So I was like, man, just like three, and also COVID. And so then there was like uncertainty and I was like, no, but this is going to be good because it's going to change the way people think about remote work.
Yeah.
Like,
I think what you just said is so true. I mean, I see that common theme all the time, like right before a pop, there's a dip or a plateau and you just got to hang on a little longer and then you reap the rewards. I love that advice. All right. So final two questions for you, kind of pivoting over to like more about you as a human, one of my favorite humans, by the way. So you're a working mom, as we've touched on. You have a toddler. You are pregnant right now with baby number two. Oh, and by the way, you have four stepkids. Like, I can literally barely handle Mila, who is generally pretty pleasant and well-behaved. Like, how are you making this work? Like, tell us about what you do to outsource, like delegate, because I mean, what you're doing is remarkable. So give us working moms some inspo and all the tips.
I love this question because I look at my life sometimes and I'm just like, what the hell am I doing? What is going on? How is this possible? I feel like women put a lot of pressure on themselves to be all things to all people. And before I had Ace, my first child, I said to myself, like, what is, my mom was a working mom. And I hated how exhausted she would be at the end of the day. And I hated how tired she would be. And I hated how she like didn't want to spend like all of her time with us all the time because I missed her, you know? And part of the reason that I missed her is because like when she was home, she was cooking or she was cleaning or she was like doing all these other things. And so even when I was making like very little money, I felt a good portion of that should go to house cleaning, should go to these services that would help free me from time so that I can spend with my child so that I'm not stressed out, so that I'm not exhausted. So I'm not any of these things. Now that of course, like I'm so grateful to have more of the ability to spend and outsource more. I have a nanny for my toddler. I have a house cleaner that comes a couple times a week and, you know, outsource laundry, outsource everything, anything that is time consuming. I outsource it because, you know, you're focused all day long on your business. When you're done, you want to be able to spend time with your children. You don't want to be, you know, cleaning or cooking. I mean, I cook because I enjoy cooking, but if there's something that you don't like doing, it is worth the money. You know, I look back at my parents. My parents they worked government jobs and they saved really well and they did a really good job of pinching pennies. They have more money now than they know what to do with. I'm super grateful and I'm super happy for them. But like, I wish they would have spent more money in my youth to have made their lives a bit easier so they could have spent more time and been more present with us.
Oh, I love that. Well, and don't you feel like the other thing too, women and men, but especially women need to do is like, what's your time worth? I mean, like, look at what you do for a living. Like, is your time better spent like washing clothes and folding them? Or is it better spent with your kid and like working when you work, right?
100%. It is absolutely spent with your kid. Now, if you can make it an activity, you can do it together. And like, again, like just a year ago, I did not have this luxury. So now that I have this luxury, like you would think that I would be like doing everything I can to pinch pennies and save as much money up again, but I'm not, because I'm like, you know what? This is the time that you need to experience these things. You need to invest in your time because again, like you said, what is your time worth? And you know, we don't know. Tomorrow's not guaranteed. We don't know. Totally.
And you can't take it with you either. That's why like calculate your hourly rate, figure out what your time is worth. And if you can hire someone to do it for less and you don't want to do it anyway, go hire them, right? Okay. Yes. So last question for you. So not only, by the way, you guys can probably really hear Mila in the background because to keep her quiet, she pulled a bag of cookies out of the pantry and she's probably eaten at least a third of it. Now she's just running around circles, whatever.
She's like a little cookie monster.
No, like literally she is a cookie monster big time. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So final question. So not only are you one of my best friends, Jacqueline, but you are one of the most fun friends I have. Jacqueline, you guys, she is a total MVP. So she flew from Texas to California for my bachelorette party, then to Italy 3 weeks later for my wedding. Like you show up for your people, and you're literally like the A team when it comes to friends that you think of when you want to have like a trip or a night to remember. So Jax, how much of that fun side do you think contributes to you being a badass businesswoman and the type of founder and CEO that people want to like follow into battle?
I mean, I would say that that is, I would like to think that it's a majority of why, because like, I'm myself. I get on the calls with the team. I'm very open. I'm a total open book. I'm completely transparent, but you know, we spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day doing this. Like no one wants it to be boring. No one wants it to be serious. Like we have our whole lives to be serious. And so I literally block off my calendar like an hour a day to think, how can I make this company more fun? How can I make people more like excited to be a part of it? And I also say like, I hate HR. I hate HR bullshit. I hate all like, I hate it. I hate it all. We don't have an HR team. I'm the head of HR. That's probably horrific, but I am. And I hate it because it's just like anytime, like life, there's so many serious things in the world. Like, I mean, I don't want to like be a Debbie Downer here, but like, look at what's happening in Afghanistan. Like, look at all these horrible, horrific things. Like if we are blessed to have this opportunity for you and I to even have this conversation, like what people take things so seriously. So like, I try and be the cheerleader. I try and loosen and liven things up in a way that makes people feel like, you know what, like I'm allowed to have fun. I'm allowed to be my own like unique self. Austin, the city of Austin has this like expression called keep Austin weird. And I have kind of stolen that for Austin Software, and I could say keep Austin Software weird. And so we try and stay weird. We try and have fun. And I think people appreciate, at least I hope people appreciate that.
Well, and you know, I forget where I heard this or who initially pointed it out to me, but you spend more time with your colleagues if you're in an office than you do with your family. Like you have to enjoy what you're doing and where you're working, or what's the point?
Yeah, what's the point? Like, gosh.
I love it. If I ever enter the corporate world again and, I can't do anything engineering related, but I would totally work for you and re-enter the corporate world. So,
hey, look, maybe you could just be like the director of fun.
There you go. Yeah, I know. I one person, if you guys haven't noticed yet, just ask Jacqueline, but we won't talk about that on the show. This is a business show. So
very serious.
So Jacqueline, where can people connect you and find out more about you and Austin Software and everything else that you're up to?
Yeah. So you can find me on Instagram. That's probably where I'm like most prominent, at Jack Samira, JACSAMIRA. Or anything about my company, austinsoftware.com. And I think we have all the handles at Austin Software or something like that. But if you can find me, I have it all linked. Yeah, there you go. Perfect. I'll get it to you.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. This was so fun. And I know this is going to be a really valuable episode, not only for anyone that wants to start their own company, but especially for women, just so many of the things we touched on. And listeners, be sure to come back later this week. So the next episode that will drop is a mini episode with Jacqueline. She's going to drop a business tip that you will not want to miss. So thank you very much for listening to the show today. If today's episode added value to your life in some way, please subscribe, leave a 5-star review, and share it with someone who would love to hear this. I would also love to connect with you on Instagram and hear how the show is inspiring or helping you. So take a screenshot of this and tag me or slide into the DMs anytime you want. I'm here for you. The show is for you. You can find me at Corporate Dropout Official or Alessia Citro. That's AlessiaCitro and 2 underscores. Until next time, remember, you are a badass. Stay focused, stay hungry, and dare to drop out.